If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable. But the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
For years, I just dreaded going to the dentist. But at Advanced Dentistry, I don't have to.
First and foremost, they want you to feel comfortable when you walk in. Like, you'll feel it. Whereas in the past, I might have gone into the dentist and thinking, I might feel some pain at some point. But with IV sedation, it can be something that you don't dread.
If you've been avoiding the dentist because of fear, worry, or just not wanting to be judged, you're not alone. Visit NoFearDentist.com to learn how IV sedation can change your life.
And now,
it's time for
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast.
Hello and welcome
to Inside Conan,
an important Hollywood podcast.
I gave you the last word.
I always get the last word.
I'm a gentleman.
Thank you, Mike Sweeney, for having me on your podcast.
Yes, and thank you for having me on your podcast. It's nice to see and hear you again.
We're always each other's guests.
You're still holding that.
I know. Oh, so I just... I'm going to tell our listeners that just received our WGA award. It was hand-delivered to me.
Uh-huh.
I'm very excited.
And what's the WGA?
Yeah, the Writers Guild of America.
Of the entire country?
Of all of America.
Oh my God, that must be a lot of writers.
Yeah.
So you had it delivered to your house and now...
It's delivered and
you're
I'm
carrying it around
for you.
From
yes,
room
I have
to
it,
room.
It hasn't left my side.
You use it for cooking and pressing clothes.
It's very heavy.
It is very heavy. I didn't get mine yet. Maybe I won't get it. Maybe they wised up.
Well, I think I know why you didn't get yours, because you told me what you do with yours. You have some already, and they are currently doorstops.
Some of them are doorstops. Some are up on prominent display. So,
and you said your son had a cute name for it.
Well, I mean, not now because he's 27. But when we first won, yeah, he called it a Rusty Stingray.
It looks like that. It's sort of a copper color.
Yeah.
You had to tell me what it is. It's a pen morphing into a bird. Or a bird morphing into a pen.
Coming down to offer its wisdom.
Onto the page.
Right.
This is how I feel when I'm writing. It's like...
Because it turns into a pen. But meanwhile, it's shitting on the rest of the page.
Yeah, that's
right? Because it's a bird. I don't think they thought this statue through.
Or maybe they exactly thought it through.
Oh my God.
What?
What's it like to be back in the United States now?
Oh, it's been so nice. I mean,
yeah.
Obviously, Paris is a wonderful city.
Right.
I got to be there for so long. I felt like I kind of lived there. Felt very
you did.
Parisian.
How long were you in Paris for?
I was there for 7 weeks. Yeah.
Wow.
And I learned approximately 4 sentences of French.
Well, you were in a bubble with Americans, right?
I was. That's okay. True. I learned more than other people did because I was at least trying to use Duolingo. And I got the best compliment.
Yes.
The last week I was there, a waiter thought that I was Spanish. He thought I was from Spain.
Oh.
Yeah. So instead of speaking English to me immediately when I spoke French, he spoke Spanish to me.
Really?
And then I was able to speak Spanish back to him. And then he was really confused. Because then he was like, wait, where are you from? Because he could tell my Spanish accent wasn't right either.
Right, right.
And then I told him the U.S. and he was surprised.
Oh.
And I felt really good about that.
I'm being a good American traveler.
Yes.
I'm representing well. I'm surprising these people.
Yes. Keeping them on their toes. These people.
These people. These goddamn continent. I call them continentals. So.
Hey.
Yeah.
We got a great show this week. Remember our show?
Right. We have a show. We have a guest. He's alive.
Guest.
Very much alive. And
he's really funny.
Oh, man. He's so funny. When he was on Conan on the TBS show, I was like, that guy he's just intimidatingly funny to
me. Yeah. I know, because he seems cool.
Yes.
Too. He seems like...
He just seems effortlessly really a funny guy.
Yeah. It's Adam Pally. We talked to Adam about some of the insane costumes that he used to wear for his Conan appearances. He was always trying to one-up himself.
As a guest, right.
Getting cut from late-night sketches in his 20s, and why he's such a huge Conan fan.
Yeah.
Finally, I want to know why. Why do people like that guy?
What is it with you? What's going on?
Name one thing.
Here's Adam.
Yeah, I think a lot of people didn't know that you used to appear in late night bits.
Yes.
Maybe they didn't actually air all the time, and that's why they don't.
Yeah, I don't think they aired. And I think if they did air, I was in a like full head to toe costume if it did air. So you wouldn't really see that it was
right.
me, but I got that sweet 450, and that was like a huge deal.
Yes.
And then they reran it.
Right.
If you were on like a good episode, you got like some residuals of rerun. That would keep you afloat.
And you never knew when those checks would come rolling in.
Those 8 cent checks.
Oh,
yeah.
God. Great.
8 cent checks for international rebroadcast.
I had already like spent the residuals in my head of Conan. Like
right,
I would
right,
be
right.
at like McManus on like a Wednesday night at 2 a.m. and be like, yeah. It's on me. I did a Conan a week and a half ago. Yeah. You see that stormtrooper that like couldn't walk straight? That was me.
His knees worked backwards. Me.
450. It was a Glazer bit.
I read a Vulture interview because you were a big fan of Late Night.
Yes.
It
yeah,
sounds
huge,
like when you
yeah.
were kind of a little burgeoning comedian.
A wee lad.
Yes.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I think, you know, there wasn't a like options for comedy to watch, you know, so like the late night shows, if you liked comedy, like that was what you that was the only thing you had, you know, because like
right.
I had seen literally every hour of programming on Comedy Central. Like I had gone through there.
Right.
You know, I'd seen every Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
I knew every like Penn Jillette voiceover between commercials. Like I knew like I knew it, you know, and like
it's time for Teller to step up.
Yeah, for real. Where was his voiceover? Conan and Letterman were like the two guys because there was no like Jon Stewart yet or anything like that.
Yeah, it was still Craig Kilborn.
Yeah, I don't even think there was a Craig Kilborn.
Yeah, there was no Daily Show yet.
There was no Daily Show. It was
right,
Tom.
Right, right. Oh, Tom Snyder.
Tom Snyder, yeah. I
mean, yes.
Which was like, Tom Snyder was like the last dinosaur, maybe Charlie Rose a little bit, but like the last dinosaur of that man, that like old white man that for some reason is on television.
And is holding forth for an hour.
If, as a kid, I would think that Tom Snyder was like also on the McLaughlin Group.
Right.
You know,
right.
like that's how I associated.
The 700 Club.
Yeah. It's yeah. like I couldn't. I was like, well, that's where the fun stops over there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But and so you were also at that, I think that ripe age, like right around becoming a teenager mm-hmm. where you're kind of like figuring out.
The target audience of late night.
Yeah. Yes. For anything yes. Conan related, we've discovered.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
And that has I mean, continued through the years. Mm-hmm. Did you know you were interested in comedy or was it a very kind of in a very broad sense at the time? Just
no, I was always interested in comedy. Like,
okay.
I would stay up to watch like SNLs and old stuff with my
right
dad and stuff. And I like very as a kid in high school would do. I got a job doing the morning announcements, which is like super cool. People love that kid.
I had that job too,
but it let me do sketches.
Right.
You know, so instead of doing like morning announcements, I would do like crazy sketches and stuff. And like, you know, I was like 15, and that became my thing. You know, it was just like funny.
Right.
Would people tell you in your high school? Were people like, "Oh, you're going to be on SNL someday"?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, like not like as open as that, because I think
they were jealous.
You know, that would have been like, what a black mark to put on a kid. It's like, you'll definitely be on SNL
by your junior year.
Trust me, I've seen a lot of people come through this Starbucks. Like, but I was voted Hollywood. Like, I don't know what the superlative was, but I was not a popular kid per se, and I was not in the plays.
Right.
Was in the school plays.
Hmm. Not a thespo.
No, and I never wasn't like in the talent show or anything musically or anything like that. But I was voted Hollywood most likely to succeed in Hollywood or something. I think it was because
most likely
it was
to
like,
have an S corp.
Yeah, yeah, most likely, yeah, most likely to know the definition of Schedule F. But my high school has a bunch of people who have graduated from it, and at the time who graduated from it, who went on to like succeed, and they were pissed. They were like.
Him.
They're like, I like go to New York every day and work with a voice coach. Like,
yeah,
this guy like cuts up South Park and puts his voice underneath it. Like, some of them are on Law and Order. Like, one of them won a Tony.
Oh,
yeah, no, like, oh, okay. I went to the same high school as Chelsea Handler and Jason Alexander.
Oh, wow. I never thought of Chelsea Handler for some reason growing up in New York City.
She is, yeah, she's a Jewess from Livingston, New Jersey.
Ah, Livingston.
I went to high school in New Jersey. I
okay,
already moved
got
back.
It, got it, got it.
My parents, they didn't have like their career set when I was born. I was born very young. So they were still actors and in a band until I was like 8. And then my dad went back to medical school, moved the family to Chicago. Then after medical school, when I was like 13, 14, he moved us back to New Jersey. Like 20 minutes outside the city to start a practice.
Oh, wow. But it sounds like you said you'd watch these comedy shows with your dad. So he must have been into comedy.
I mean, that's still all he wants to talk about is like...
That's great.
Actors and theater and my career and where I fit in the pantheon of stars.
Pitching you ideas.
Oh, my God. Constantly. He read...
Yeah.
He loves when I book something, he's like, gets offended if I don't send him the script immediately.
Oh, wow. That seems like a generational shift where parents used to be like, well, you're going to go into medical school or you're going to become a lawyer. And
yes,
I swear now it's, well, no, you're going to please tell us you're going into show business.
Yeah, no, I mean, my parents also were so cool. Like, I was lucky enough, like I wasn't as cool as my parents, which I believe is a generational thing as well. You know what I mean? Like my parents' generation is the first generation. Like, they were fucking cool. Like, my dad was the first face of Levi's buttonfly jeans. He's like so handsome and ripped still.
Oh, wow.
And like my mom, their act, like they used to have the funniest like vaudeville act. They used to open for Joan Rivers and like,
oh my God.
You know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, so like I didn't have any friends because we were constantly moving around. I was like kind of chubby, and I like would like shake your hand with a buzzer and be like, like, you know, like, you know, it's like a weird, like joking Nelson,
right?
You know, like,
right.
And so that was like an odd thing, because all my other friends, like, they were like not as, they like their parents were dorks, you know?
Right.
So when I showed like a flair for it, my parents were like, yes, do it. Like, they were like, finally he likes something, he's not just like smoking weed, like at least he has like a interest. They put every, like, I went to the New York Film Academy when I was like 15 and learned how to edit on a Steinbeck and stuff, while all my other friends were like, you know, off on teen tours and stuff. Like, my parents were like, no, do it, go do it. And I rebelled against that by like putting off acting school after high school. I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. I was like,
I'm going to medical school.
I was like, I'm going to the University of Arizona. My mom was like, no. I was like, I'm going to major in communications. My dad was like, what
what a threat.
Yeah. I was like, I'm going to get a job at one of my friend's dad's offices. My mom was like, we don't have a son.
I'm going to get a pension after 10 years of vesting.
Yeah. They just were like, I remember that moment. They were like, look, we're not going to stop you, but we're not like, we're not happy about this.
Right.
Yeah.
We will sit Shiva for you.
So at what point were you then like, all right,
well,
fine. Yes.
You know, it was weird. It's like, I got to U of A and I had a great time, like met a bunch of friends and like instantly was like, this is awesome. It's like, if you don't go to class, you're just on vacation. Like,
right.
You know, it's basically just a warm.
That school's famous for.
Party. Yeah.
Yes.
And so I did that for like 2 years and was like on and off academic probation and just like spending all my bar mitzvah money on drugs, like just like not, you know,
in the desert,
cashing out Israeli bonds at like a Puma County, you know, like just like not a great time. But I was like, at the same time, I was young.
But you were learning about life.
Right.
I was learning about life. I was also learning, like I felt on the outside, even though I was not on the inside when I was, you know, in high school, obviously. But it was like from giving up on, even for like 2 years from like, you know, 18 to 20, from like being like, I'm not involved in that. I'm not even seeking out comedy. I'm just like, you know, I'm just like one of the funny guys, you know, like I was really unhappy and like really depressed. And my best friend had hooked me up with another good friend, and we went to see a show at the Upright Citizens Brigade. And then I was like, okay, I'm never going back to Arizona.
Wow.
Wow.
It just immediately, it all crystallized.
Yeah. I was like, oh. People talk, like I had that feeling where I was like a 20-year-old kid and I was watching like, you know, like Rob Riggle and Paul Scheer and Jack McBrayer, and like my skin was like on fire. I was like, oh my God. Like,
yeah.
And I wanted to walk on stage.
Right.
<know?
laughs> Right.
Like I literally remember like that, like my hair, my whole body was like, I'm walking on that stage, you know?
Wow.
Thank God I didn't. But like I was like, that's what I wanted to do.
It was the voice of God.
Right.
Yeah, kind of. It sounds like fucking Riggle being like, get up!
Wow.
And they didn't seem that much older than me.
Right.
You know, like it all seemed attainable. And and Amy was there.
Amy Poehler.
And I had seen her on
Amy Poehler.
And I had seen her on her television show. I knew the Upright Citizens Brigade had a show because I had kept up with Comedy Central.
They had a sketch show on TV.
Comedy Central.
There you go.
And so I would like identified her as being on television. Was like, oh, it's like a linear. It just seemed like grad school. I was like, I just sign up here. And at the time, there was nothing else really going. I mean, there was like this alternative comedy scene downtown that was older than me. Like, I didn't get to like pianos and stuff like that. I was like too young. I couldn't even go into a bar. You know, like,
right.
I was 20. So like, I missed that whole thing because I was like, well, this is a school. I can go here at 20, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And that was it.
My parents will understand this.
Yeah. My parents were beyond. They were like, yes, thank God. Like
he's learning a trade.
They were so happy. Oh my God. And they came to every single show from my student show until, you know, up until my mom passed away. I think she was going to see like Ass Cats and stuff like.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They loved it because they were like, they understood it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Whereas most parents wouldn't understand. It was so easy for them to be like, oh, my son's on stage getting laughs from a bunch of people underneath a supermarket.
He's living out our dreams.
Yeah. He's very happy and very good at it. Like that seems like that's enough, you know? And there was no pressure to do more than that. It was just like very exciting time. And that lasted probably way longer than most actors would have liked.
Well, so was it during this time that you started getting cast in Conan sketches, or how did that start happening?
Yes, that started happening. It was like another crazy thing about that time in New York specifically was the wealth of talent that was just like around, you know, like
just hanging out. Yeah.
Just completely. Not even just hanging out, just like learning and bombing and drinking and doing bits in diners and stuff. Was like,
right.
You could do that every night with a different person who would go on to make over like $1 billion at the box office.
Right. It's true.
You know, I mean, that sounds insane.
Yeah.
But
everyone in retrospect was famous.
It's a fact.
Yeah.
I was talking about this the other day with Paul Scheer, and I was like, I think if you really did add up like the amount of projects from the time that we were in New York, the amount of people that I had taken a class with or done a show with or you name it, like been involved in that scene, had a flyer that said like this name, this name, this name.
Right.
I bet that you would be at probably more than $5 billion.
Yeah.
Wow.
And at the time,
it was like you couldn't throw a stone without hitting one of those people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I think some people take off where you're like, oh, absolutely. I saw that coming from day one. And then some people you're like,
sure.
Wow. Okay. They're a billionaire.
Them, huh? Yeah.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, there's always that like, that's the beauty of Hollywood and comedy and this job is like, you know, John Hamm doesn't break until he's 45.
Right.
It's like, if you stick with it and you have something to offer, like you will.
Yeah.
You will find it. Mm-hmm. It may not be like tomorrow or next week or whatever. And it may be something that you have to like think of. It may not be like someone casting you.
Right.
If you want to do it, like you can do it, I think. Now I had like obviously like the luxury of supportive parents and I'm white. But like I think now has never been a better time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I've always thought it's kind of an attrition thing where it's like, you know, a lot of people do drop off and end up getting other real careers because they have to get money somehow. But yeah, if you stick in there long enough and you have something to offer, eventually it will probably work out.
Right. Sure. The real world example I would use is like when I got to Upright Citizens Brigade, my best friend had another best friend who was moving to New York and we got hooked up, and that kid's name is Doug Mant. Doug and I lived together in the East Village, and a third roommate lived on the couch, Dan Greger. Now, Doug Mant, Dan Greger have gone on to probably make billions of dollars in television and movies as professional screenwriters. At the time, they were stank Jews that were like transferred from Brandeis.
Stank Jews.
And Skidmore.
Never heard that.
And we were living in the East Village.
That's her formal title.
They got me, even though the rules didn't allow it, a job as a writer on their NYU sketch team called Hammercats.
Oh, I love that.
Now, I was writing for a group that already contained two people who've made over $1 billion. Then you had in Donald Glover, who was...
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The star of that sketch group with DC Pearson, who has gone on to be a famous author, Dominic DeYerkes, who has gone on to make, let's say, $25 million worth of television. I don't know what his box office is, a TV writer.
And these are not what they're making, but that's
no,
the
no,
gross.
Not their salaries. Yeah, yeah. I'm saying the gross of their, what they're known for.
Right.
So now you have six. Then you have Fran Gillespie, who goes on years later to become the head writer of SNL currently. I mean, and like, that was just that sketch group.
Wow.
One group.
Yeah.
You know, and like there's probably 30 of those groups that where you could
every
go
year.
Every person,
right,
you know, has kind of gone on. And so I, you know, that's how I got Conan, was at a time when there was nobody else. There was like, if you weren't funny, you were decimated and kicked out of the scene.
Right.
And so they started to cast younger and younger from people that they saw. And so when they needed like a bro or something, or a bear, a guy in a bear costume or whatever, like that was me.
Yeah, I think Donald Glover did one of his first TV appearances was in a sketch on Conan.
Oh, wow.
I'm sure it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like that time, the lack of other people around besides the most hilarious
talented people
is so I feel lucky that I like at that time went into that creepy, I guess Besser was living there and like signed up for that class, you know.
Right.
He was sleeping in the back. What do you have early memories of, like, because that must have been a little bit surreal for you to start doing sketches on late night. And you were like, I've been watching this with my dad and now I'm here. You know, what was your thought going in? Was it like, oh, it's some people have said it's smaller than they thought it was going to be, or
the studio?
I spent a lot of time in that hallway, like sitting in these plastic chairs in that hallway waiting to find out if it was gonna go or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Was like a lot of the time.
Like a dentist's office.
I'm curious, was it a weird, some people get a little intimidated when you're performing and all of a sudden, you know, there's the television cameras with the red tally light on, and were things like that an adjustment as opposed to just doing?
No.
Not at all.
No, I was excited. And again, like I had gone to a high school that had like some editing booths, and I had gone to the New York Film Academy, and like I was ready like for my shot.
Right.
Yeah.
And it never really materialized into anything, you know, but I was like going to give 150% and like not get scooted.
In your bear costume.
Yeah. And I never got to, luckily, I never got to do one of those things. Like I remember my, I don't think he'd be upset if I said my good friend, Nick Kroll, early on in his career, got booked to do like a big bit with Conan.
Yeah.
And he was like on screen and he wasn't in a costume. He was like playing a guy. It was like, it could have been like guy in audience or something or like whatever. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
that sounds accurate.
He got to do it with, so like, you know, Conan started talking to him, you know?
Yeah.
And like, I never had to do that. And I think that maybe I would have been super. Yeah. I could see myself at the time like throwing up in a bucket.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable. But the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You'd tape something and then you'd be waiting to find out if it was going to air or not. Like what?
Like the one bit that I got cut from that did air was there was a call for three young boys to come in and wear American flag Speedos on a green
that wasn't
screen
for the show. And,
no, this was just for Conan. He just wanted to, it was just like a favor.
He still loves that video.
And you got cut from the favor.
I don't remember what that exact bit was, but they called my sketch group at the time, which was me and Ben Schwartz and Gil Ozeri, both amazingly hilarious, hugely successful comedians now, actors and writers. And so the three of us were like three young Jewish boys. So they like called us in. They put us in the Speedos and everything. And they only used Ben and Gil.
Oh,
and
no.
I believe Ben actually got to be like hoisted and flown through like on a green screen in his Speedo, which was awesome. And it was so fun. But I spent the day in that Speedo,
in
a cropped t-shirt in the hallway, waiting to see if it was going to be three boys or two boys.
Oh no.
I think the reason I got called back was 'cause like, I was like totally happy. I left that day being like, I got paid my $450.
Yeah,
I didn't get the 12 because I didn't make it on, but like,
gotta keep the Speedo.
Yeah, I remember like getting, we all got undressed and went to do a show. Like it was like, it was rad. I remember being totally like, okay, thank you. Like feeling awesome about it.
Right. I'll be back.
Which is delusional.
Yeah,
which is delusional.
No, but yeah, you probably are thinking, okay, this is the first step and I'll be back.
Yeah, it had that vibe, you know, and like,
right,
and then
right.
It felt good.
Yeah.
You know, even though it was bad.
Well, and I'm sure, like you said, I mean, you're having a good attitude probably meant that they were like, okay, we have a good memory of this guy. We'll call
him
back.
Yeah, it was like, it was nice. I mean, a lot of people...
He's got a good vibe.
Like, a lot of my friends would make it on, like, all the time.
Right.
And at the time, you would see a lot of, like, my favorite Conan writers were performers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I was a nerd about it. So I knew, like, who was in what sketch and who wrote right. what sketch and everything. And so then as you got, you know, if you went to ASCAT on a Sunday, you saw Stack and McCann and
Brian
Glazer
Stack.
And, yeah. you know,
and John
yeah,
Glazer, yeah,
Miriam, you know, like those.
Colin.
You saw everybody do it.
Right.
You know, and you're like, oh, that it just like it's all just part of. Yeah. You just do this until you do that. And then you do them both at the same time. And, you know, like it all just seemed like it made sense to me.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned that you're kind of pals with Brian Stack. Did you meet him? Did that all happen kind of organically on Sunday nights at ASCAT or?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I wouldn't say pals. Like,
well, yeah.
we're pals.
Yes.
The theater does have, because there's like a little bit of like when young people ascend, there's like a threat. Right. Especially if there's right. like older people who haven't ascended. Mm-hmm. It's a threat. And so sometimes on Sunday nights, it could feel there was a tension.
Like competitive. Yeah.
Yeah. You know. And so one of my first times, like Stack was just so nice to me and like so interested in like what I was doing and asking me about stuff backstage or my career. And like I was doing ASCAT like filling in for someone. Like there was. You know what I mean? Like I was like 24. Right. There was no one.
Right.
Literally, everyone was out of town except Stack and Miriam. Like,
right.
And he was just so nice to me and interested. And then we just kept up this like comedic rapport because I would see him every Sunday. And then when they moved to LA, we just kept in touch, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when you're in that new environment like that, like you're talking about, it could be a little, this kind of unspoken tension and stuff. You're just, it's like a moth to a light. If there's one friendly, welcoming person there, you're just like, oh my, it's like a lifesaver thrown your way. And just like, oh my God.
Completely.
I'm going to cling to this person being so generous and, yes. and nice to me.
And I think he could probably tell that until I was scared. Until I was scared.
Why is he in our home now?
I think he probably could tell. And like, I've been lucky to have some people. I mean, obviously everyone in their careers, like I've had people be nice to me. I've had some people be not nice to me, but I've been very lucky that for the most part, people like that I admire have been very kind to me. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think that keeps you from being jaded about it all.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Also that must be reaffirming about your own talent and belonging there when people you admire positively respond to you. That's a nice sign.
Right.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was a good sign. I mean, like, and there were definitely other people that night that were like, ugh, what is this guy doing?
Right.
But like, Brian doesn't care about that.
Right.
Especially on stage, Brian is very, like, you could say he's welcoming to anything. And that's the whole point of it in a way.
He's generous.
He's
unbelievable.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. He's so talented.
Oh.
You know, he can be generous, no problem.
And he's not like gunning for anything. And so it makes doing a scene with him really great. And I think probably to this day, his vibe is something that I try to bring into any new scene I do.
Almost be outside yourself and look at the big picture and go, this isn't a big deal in the grand scheme of things. And just kind of have fun with it.
I think you have to, otherwise I mean, I don't know, because I've never been to like the heights of grand, like I've never like performed in front of a ton of people like that, but like I would assume that that the people that get really, really nervous and it affects their performance are the ones who can't have perspective in the moment.
Right.
This is everything. Everything's riding on this.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
People don't book auditions when they're like that. People don't, you know, do their best job interviews when they're like that.
No, it just comes across.
Speaking of auditions, I'm curious, when you got cast on Happy Endings, which was like a huge sitcom role.
Yeah.
Was that based on auditions? Did you already know some people there?
I was out in LA doing my sketch show for like literally like packing the UCB LA and like trying to like get
people
representation and stuff.
Yeah.
And like, you know,
the hustle.
And some casting director was there and called me in for Community. And I went in for Community and I read and met the Russos and they were like, we were not going to cast you in this show, but we have this other show in a couple months. Can you come back to LA and read? And I was like, yeah. And then I went home and I had just gotten married. So I was like, baby, we're moving to LA.
Right. I'm doing the other show.
I got a promise of another audition. Yeah.
Yeah. In a couple of months.
You know how they say people move there on a dream? Well, this is the definition of it.
This is less than that.
Some Hollywood guy named Joe Russo has promised me a first look. No, but I had also just felt like, you know, it was enough for me at the time.
You had that tingle, the spidey sense was tingling again.
Yeah, I'm ready. Yeah. And it worked out, and then I went and I auditioned, and again, luckily for me, like I'm not the best auditioner, if you can believe it. I'm an acquired taste.
That's interesting, because you seem so kind of chill that I would
cucumber
think that
cool.
would
cool. Yeah,
yeah,
I am very calm in the auditions. I am right. often wrong for it.
Just going to bring up the fact that Jonathan Groff was the showrunner on Happy Endings. Mm-hmm. It used to be the head writer on Conan. Mm-hmm. Had you met him before? Was that just a complete
random connection? And Groff will tell you, like, I nerded out a whole pilot. I was just like, wouldn't leave Groff alone. I was just like telling everything about Conan, like, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was just like wanted to know everything about the writer's room and wanted to know uh-huh. everything about those first couple of years and like was going over my favorite bits with him. And
You should be hosting this podcast.
That's right.
No.
Groff's a good guy to nerd out with because he's got an amazing memory.
Because he's a nerd.
He remembers everything. He does. He's won. Yeah.
He was a five-time Jeopardy champ.
He won five times?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, five times in a row.
I was campaigning for Groff when all that was going down for Conan to host Jeopardy. which would have been the greatest.
Or Andy. Huh.
Andy, too. That's what Groff said. Andy would be great at it, too.
Andy would be great.
Yeah, anything more like slightly comedic.
Right.
So I was like nerding out with Groff. And I was, and then when I got on when Happy Endings got on the air, mm-hmm. Groff was like, I bet I can get you like on.
Oh.
And he did.
Oh, booked on the show. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did that happen? He just...
Well, it was precarious. When Happy Endings first like took off, there were six young leads who all like got publicists right away.
Uh-huh.
And there was like this feeding frenzy of people being like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this. And I remember being like, I just want to do like the late night circuit. Like I got to do late night, mm-hmm. you know, huh. and I really want
to
do late night.
I don't have
and,
to go to Cannes, but I want
to. Yeah, no, it's like, I don't need to do the London. I remember being like, I don't need to do like the London upfronts, which everyone is like, it's such a fun trip. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't need to do that.
Right.
And it just worked out that I got to do Conan. And it was great. It was really good.
Well, and yeah, you did a really smart thing when you started appearing as a guest, which is you kind of had a recurring bit where you'd dress up in costume.
Yeah.
Did you do that the first time you were on?
I wore a tuxedo.
Okay.
I think.
So you overdressed.
And I overdressed.
Right.
And then the second time, I think I was a Buckingham Palace guard.
Yes.
Right, right. A beefeater.
Yeah, a beefeater. And I didn't overdress, but I got it wrong.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great. Then you were trying to top yourself and you. They got more and more insane.
It's Jim Carrey as the mask, but also Abraham Lincoln.
Right. Because I forgot to cancel one or the other. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That was a good one.
And then Fat Man. The Fat Man suit.
Batman. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've never seen a fat suit that was that fantastic.
It was great. It was the best fat suit.
It was almost like a beanbag or something.
Yeah,
inside.
It looked so like pliable. You wanted to grab it.
Well, again, you guys are the best. Like I think I had already, Mike, you would know probably better than me, but I feel like at the time I had already had a little bit of currency.
Right.
And so people were like into the bit. So they,
yes.
That time I remember they called me and were like, what do you want to do? We can help.
Ah.
And so I, you know, you guys have the best
great wardrobe people. Yeah.
Costume department in Hollywood.
Yes.
And so it was like, when I got there, I was like, oh, this is perfect. It did feel like I was having a heart attack. Like the weight of the suit was like so heavy and was like, when I sat down, it was resting on my chest so much.
Oh, wow.
That I was like, oh my God, I can see how this is a hard existence.
It's actually giving me heart disease. Yeah.
Did you ever, like, halfway through or during any of the costumes you wore, halfway through an interview, were you kind of like, oh, why did I wear this? Did you ever have regrets about picking something out?
No, I once it was going, I mean, like, honestly, again, like Conan.
Yeah.
And Andy, and I had known Andy, he would sometimes do ASCAT and stuff. And then he came on mm-hmm. Happy Endings early on as a favor to Groff and really helped us out.
Uh-huh.
And so we became friends from that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I knew that at the very least, Andy wasn't going to let it go bad.
Right, right.
You know,
right,
even right. if like Conan hated it and was like, right. At least I knew Andy was going to keep me afloat.
Right.
There was a couple of times like the Daredevil costume. Or I keep getting
wrong. Yeah.
It's not even Daredevil. What is
oh, Snare Devil.
Yeah, no, it was Deadpool.
Deadpool.
Yeah. Deadpool. And then you took the mask off and you had the Daredevil mask underneath.
Yeah, yeah.
That one, again, like your makeup department was so amazing
yeah.
that they had gotten the exact like black contact lenses.
Oh, for the
Deadpool. Oh, cool.
Wow.
And they put them in my eyes.
Ooh.
And like, I was like, I can't see anything.
Like, yeah.
Too realistic.
I can't see anything. You got to get these out of my fucking eyes. I was like that Tim Robinson sketch. It was like, there's too much shit on me. And like, they had to come in and like pull them out. And then right from there, I went right on and it was like a little scramble. But
oh, wow.
But no, I mean, like, even that was like,
yeah.
That's part of it. That's like fun.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and no, Conan loved it. You could tell he loved all of them because his favorite thing is having a funny guest. He'd always say like, oh, having a funny guest who's actually thought about.
Oh, yeah.
Their appearance. Yeah.
Come with an idea. It's just, it's like a gift to him. It's literally like walking in with a gift. Like the next 5 minutes you can
relax,
kind of relax.
He's the one of the only ones that lets you do that because of that. I think there's a certain right. security that he has in his own. I mean, Conan knows he's the funniest person on the planet. He knows that inherently. And so
no one's told him.
Yeah, I know no one's told him, but he's decided. And so yeah. like, you know, like he's so comfortable in that.
Right.
And knows.
Right. He's not worried about someone upstaging him.
Ever.
Yeah. No.
Whereas I do think, I'm not going to like name names.
Mm.
I do think there's a certain element of like, let's not do anything nuts here because this is we do this show like this. And this is what we do here. And this is how we get our clips out the next day.
Right.
And this is like, mm-hmm. you know, and to me, that's fine. And those shows are allowed to have their.
Right. And Triscuits has already bought this segment. So we have.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. It's like, and that is
you
the
don't
way.
Don't want to piss them off.
Not Big Wheat.
Yeah.
You don't want to pick up.
Right.
Big
right,
Wheat.
No.
But like, yeah. So like Conan is always like, yeah, do it. Because I like it.
Right.
You know, it's like amusing.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about this a lot with Groff, and I feel like I've talked about it with Conan, but like, I take those talk show appearances like very seriously
mm-hmm.
and like workshop stuff on stage. And like, I think about that stuff and write it and rewrite it and go over it and think about how I'm going to play it for like weeks when I get a.
Mm-hmm.
talk show appearance because
mm-hmm.
the people that I love, the careers that I look at, those talk show appearances are part of their, when you ask me like, what do you love about Will Ferrell? It's not just the movies. Like I love when he came on dressed as a leprechaun, like
yeah.
that bit, and you could find it right. online. Like that's, I love that.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to do that. And
mm-hmm.
some places will let you and some places won't. And Conan, it could only be good. Even if it's bad, it can only be good.
Right, right, right. He also loves anarchy.
Yeah.
And I think you two together
yeah.
are perfect for that because I think you also kind of love...
Like thrive in chaos.
Right. And
yeah.
create a little discomfort before the things get really out of control.
Yeah, I think it's why like when we spent time alone personally, we don't always like hit it off through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say the same thing. because I do think like I think we are dangerous together in a way. It's like two negative batteries.
Right. So you have to keep things tamped down.
Yeah. Which is the thing that I love about
right.
it because like like when Jeff Garland was there,
uh-huh.
it was really fun
uh-huh.
because it was one of the only times that I've been on Conan where I wasn't the idiot. And it was just great because it was like, you could see Conan. Once Jeff got involved in my bit and it was like Conan was really excited to not have to make me the idiot, and then we could do it together.
Right.
And it became, I could feel the electricity go up again. This is gonna, could get someone killed.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying, where it's like we could never date because we'd be too...
Yes.
The chemistry would be too intense.
Conan and I would not. We need a mediator.
Yeah.
You need someone to be like, no, no.
That sounds dreamy.
I'm glad to hear you, though. I like hearing that you prepare for those appearances, because I think it demystifies a little bit of the, like, people think like, oh, people just show up and they're funny. But the reality is being good and funny on TV requires preparation and planning. It's not just,
I mean,
a lot
there's
of work.
Like all that the pre-interview is such a big deal. It's so hard. Right. Mm-hmm. It's really like, you guys do a great job at it, but it's really challenging to, like, you know, you never met the person you're about to talk to most of the time, or you have, and, you know, it's like, and then the things you're going to talk about are like basically cues.
Yeah.
So like that's what, when you see like celebrities backstage at a show and they're going over their note cards to go out on late night, you're like, what are they looking at? It's like, they're looking at the punchline to the joke that's going to be set up by the host that they've rehearsed.
Yep.
Right.
And that's good and okay. Mm-hmm. I don't want to bomb on late night. I want it to be special.
Right.
Is this a Conan quote? I don't know. I feel like it's a Conan quote about when late night started to like shift into social media.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you just want good moments. You don't want, like, you want to have a good moment. That makes a successful segment. It's like a good moment.
Mm-hmm.
Something memorable.
Something memorable, because so much of it is like a step and repeat at times.
Right. Yes.
Just make sure that whatever bit you do, even now I try to do it, and some places will, some places won't. I try to be like, well, I want, it's like something memorable.
Right.
Yeah. So it rises above the fray a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. Because why, what else is there in life? Like, what are you going to just like get in a suit and walk on?
Right.
Like, just great, you did it. Like everybody else?
Yeah, you did it. Like, it's so easy for someone to make you look hot. Like, we're all sitting here right now. We could all look hot walking out as a guest on Conan.
If we wanted to.
There are a few things I could have done to spruce things up. But.
Yeah, of course. But you know what I mean.
If you've done all the prep and it goes really well, it all looks like there was no preparation at all. And it was all just ad-libbing, you know, which is
the hope.
Yes.
And a lot of times in Conan and I's, it would get there because it was like, it would just be like too hard not to comment on what was going on.
Right.
You know, like when I can start
believing. Yeah, and two really good improvisers, that makes sense.
Right.
They're gonna...
Yeah. And also like, you know, when the Jim Carrey one, like those teeth were so big, I couldn't breathe. Like, what's he going to do? Be like, tell me about Sonic the Hedgehog. Like, no.
That's what amazed me. Like, are you distracted by the weight or the just the heft of these costumes? But I guess once you're out there.
I mean, you are. But like, that's the fun of it. That's like,
For
me, it came to a point where I could identify the skill set used to do a late night appearance as something that I had been trained to do my whole life.
Right.
Doing 5 minutes, owning 5 minutes with no material is something that like I've been perfecting. Like that's where I've got my 1,000 hours.
That's the morning announcement.
You know, like my whole life. Like that's, I've literally been doing that. So I identified it very early as like something that felt like, oh, I understand what this is. This is like when you go on a casting.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like or like when you're pitching, sometimes it even feels like pitching, you know, cause you're like talking about a project. Like I identify that feeling. And so I wanted to like not do anything like that with Conan because it would be a waste.
Yeah.
You know, like it would have been a waste. Like I would come off of a Conan show and be like, whoa, holy shit. You know, so excited. Yeah. And like the emails would start coming in on the East Coast, and then, you know, I'd start getting them.
Right.
Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And I'd be like, yes. You know, like
mission accomplished.
For me, that's everything. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
But also, I love the arc to all your guest appearances. Like if you edited them together, like you start with the tuxedo and then you just kept building from there. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that's kind of a neat...
It's heightening, yeah.
You could almost do a cool montage of them and just see how you kept topping yourself each time, which...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's kind of, that's a huge challenge.
Yeah, there was talk of one. I don't think we never got to do it, but I had talked to Damon Wayans Jr. Mm-hmm. And what we were going to do was he was going to go out and do the whole interview with Conan as me. And then I would stay after and overdub it with my voice.
Oh, my God.
And so there would be a moment where Conan would be like, Adam, is that you in there? Right. And I would be like, yeah, Conan, I really went for it.
Your makeup team's incredible.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I hope Conan comes back.
Yeah.
In some form. So we get to see another.
Oh,
you have to top yourself.
Yeah. No, I would be so lucky to be invited.
Or I just want you guys to start fucking off camera. Either way.
Well, like there would be times like Conan, I told this story once, but Conan, I had an office in Sherman Oaks. Mm-hmm. And Conan would come into the sushi place sometimes. And then sometimes he'd come to the counter, which was across the street.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And on the day that Donald Trump was elected,
yes,
I was eating at the counter alone because it was horrific.
Just three milkshakes. You know,
it was like a horrific day.
Right.
And Conan walked in and sat next to me. And I was like, I know I have to do a bit, but I feel so... decimated.
Right.
So I turned to him and I said, hello. And then I went back to eating as if I didn't know him. And he was like, Adam, like the whole restaurant.
We've met.
The whole restaurant turned around.
It's me, Conan.
And like, then we sat and that was the only bit we did. And we sat and like, we didn't talk the whole lunch. We just were like, pretty silent.
Yeah.
And then we emailed that night after like the final call and we were like, I think I wrote him like, we are now forever tied to each other.
Yeah.
And he wrote back, no, we're not.
But honestly, I feel like you're describing his interactions with his best friends where it's like,
it's all a bit.
It's just a bit. It's a bit. And then that's it. And then it's over.
I operate that way. So I look at that lunch as like one of the greatest days of my life, even though it was the Trump election.
Yeah.
But like I did a bit with Conan that carried into email.
Right.
You know, and like that's.
And you both committed the whole lunch. I love it. It's like, well, he didn't stony silence.
No one said anything to each other. We just sat there because it was like, and we just sat there and he ate his like grilled chicken sandwich or whatever he made. Right. Weird concoction that he put together at the counter.
Fake healthy thing. Yeah.
It's like, I never saw someone take so long to fill out a burger, custom burger menu. Let's go, dude.
That was a bit too, right?
Well, Adam, thank you so much for coming on the show. Before we wrap up,
thank you.
Is there any Conan memory? I mean, you've already given us a lot, but anything that you haven't mentioned, a favorite Conan memory, could be on or off screen if we haven't already talked about it.
I'm trying to think of like my favorite, like there's so many bits from when I was a kid, like, you know, old timey baseball or, you know,
right.
Mm-hmm.
That like really stand out for me as formative, especially with like the idea of like talking head comedy.
Right.
I think the one where he was a Mountie, where he went to be a Mountie.
Right. In Toronto by the Canadian border and was helping. That was 2004.
So that bit.
Yeah.
Maybe my favorite Conan bit.
Oh.
I love him on the road with people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't have to worry about what Channing Tatum's movie is about to get Conan being funny. I can like.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's my favorite Conan bit.
Oh, that's cool.
I don't have a memory of like what my favorite memory was because I look at all of them as the same thing.
Right.
Like they're all
the favorite.
Yeah. Right. They're all. It's like you can't look at the last one without the first one. You know,
it's true.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Adam.
Thanks, Adam. Great chatting with him.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah.
Guess what?
I don't
We've got a listener question.
Right. That's what we do after the interview.
You could have guessed that. Yes. Hey, should I go ahead and read it?
Please read it. Yes.
Jesse and Mike, I was wondering what the show's protocol was in response to an event in which the show wanted to make a statement about. Does Conan write the statements himself or does the writing team put together something for him? Did the writing team ever proactively create statements if a major event is imminent, whether world event or celebrity passings? Thank you for your time and all the memories you've shared. Tim S.
Tim.
Thanks, Tim. Tim wants to know if we pre-write obituaries for people.
Tim hates comedy, but he loves
He loves
when we
somber statements
deal with world tragedies or personal tragedies on the show.
Well, it is an interesting question because that did come up a lot.
Yes, it did. And it
seemed like it started to happen a lot more.
It did. And it kind of bummed everyone out because,
yeah,
I mean, I think that's a great question because, yeah, for years, I mean, I don't think late night shows normally had to comment on what was going on in the world.
That was tragedies.
Right. That was part of, as far as I know, I think it all changed with 9/11. It always goes back to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and everyone
ruined everything.
And David Letterman was the first one to comment on it. And then everyone else commented. And then after that, there would be world events or tragedies where I think all the talk show hosts felt like it was just so serious that it seemed weird to just come out.
To go on and do sketch comedy.
Yeah, or a monologue that just ignored it. And then,
right.
And then talking about something serious and then going, okay, now, you know, here's
the fart.
Meanwhile,
machine.
Let's see what George W. Bush is up to today. Like that seemed like a weird left turn. So then there were events where Conan would just come out and address what was going on that day and then say, okay, but, you know, we're doing a show and our guests are here. So, like, you know, we jettison the written, prepared comedy and then do the interviews because it's just a more somber situation.
But it was a little hard to know what would kind of meet that.
Right.
Criteria, because it's, I mean, especially in the
U.S., slippery slope.
There are a lot of gun violence tragedies here, and it started becoming like how many casualties?
That was the other awful part where everyone gets numb, and then you're just like, it was only 8 people, but it's literally that crazy metric all of a sudden.
It's all the time.
It's just an indicator of, how numb everyone gets. And to answer your question, for these serious, where Conan was going to be talking about something, he would go off in the early afternoon and write something himself, usually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I sometimes just talk like we'd be in a group or there'd be a group of writers or whatever, and you just kind of talk out the event because it was
try to process it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Conan always would just be like, you know, I'm going to go off and I'm going to chew this over and write something. And and then he'd send it to our script supervisor, John Croteau, and it would be on cue cards right before the show. And that's when we'd all see it and go, oh, I mean, it was usually, he's a great writer.
Turns out he is. Yeah.
Yeah. It turns out he's a great writer. Whether he's being, you know, obviously hilarious, but when he has to be serious,
he could do that too.
He's like a laser.
Yeah.
I think. So, you know, inevitably we'd be like, oh yeah, that's, you wrote something great. And I think those kind of speeches would resonate. If they did resonate with people, which I think they did, it's because I think the key was it was truly from Conan and from his heart. And he,
yeah. And happening in the moment. And
yeah. And just, it was his take.
Yeah.
And thoughts on the situation. So
the other part of the question mm-hmm. was when there would be a celebrity death.
Right.
And this also would change the makeup of the show. If a person who had been on the show or kind of important to the show died, then we would rush to put together a tribute montage.
Right. And that, again, that didn't happen until the last few years because prior to that, everyone was still alive.
Yeah.
But you know what? Like because he's been interviewing and meeting people since 1993, things are catching up where, you know, all these friends of the show are passing away.
Got old.
It's a weird turn of events. Like when Norm Macdonald died, that was just...
That was really sudden.
Or someone like David Bowie, who had been on the show a few times. And
mm-hmm.
I think Conan felt like was delighted having him as a guest because he was funny and personable and you know, you saw a different side of him
and probably a hero and
because he wrote a song named Heroes.
If it was usually if it was somebody sort of who was a big comedy presence or
right.
was particularly important to the show or to Conan personally.
Yes.
It wasn't like, oh, Madeleine Albright died and now we're gonna have our Madeleine Albright montage.
She was never on the show.
Yeah.
In her memoir, this is one of her great regrets. I remember And she saved it for the last most potent chapter, my things I wish I could fix. I could have been on Conan with John Goodman. And I said, no. Well, I hope we answered that question.
I think we did. I think we answered the question.
Well, so that's our show for the week.
Sorry to end on such a somber note.
It was kind of a somber note. How do we...
But we're always circling towards death anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that's always the subtext of any podcast. I mean, the true crime ones are so...
Yeah, those are very on the nose.
They're so blatant about it, but we try to be a little more subtle. But of course, death is always lurking.
Yes, that's why we all went into comedy in the first place.
Exactly.
And if you guys have questions about death or about the Conan show, you can submit them. You can call us. We have a voicemail line.
Right.
323-209-5303. That's with a plus one area code.
Can I do the email address?
Yeah, you can do the email, Sween.
You can write us at insideconanpod@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Oh, good job. You did great. I'm obliged to say that if you like the show, you can support us by rating Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast, on iTunes.
Right.
And leaving us a review.
Sure.
Yeah.
If that's how you want to spend your time. Knock yourself out.
And hey,
yeah?
In the meantime, until we talk to you again,
yes.
Don't die.
Right.
Because you know what? We love you.
Oh.
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast, is hosted by Mike Sweeney and me, Jesse Gaskell.
Produced by Sean Doherty. Our production coordinator is Lisa Byrne.
Executive produced by Joanna Solotaroff, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross at Team Coco.
Engineered and mixed by Will Beckton.
Our talent bookers are Gina Batista and Paula Davis.
Thanks to Jimmy Vivino for our theme music and interstitials.
You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts.
And of course, please subscribe and tell a friend to listen to Inside Conan on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or whatever platform you like best.
It's the Conan Show. Put on your hat. It's the Conan Show. Try on some spats. You're gonna have a laugh. Give birth to a calf. It's Conan.
This has been a Team Coco production.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable. But the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.